Welcome to While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Paul Bowers. Jace is out this week, so you've just got me today, and I expect y'all to be on your best behavior. On May 26th, something good and surprising happened in our state. We stopped the plan to redraw congressional election maps, at least for now. And when I say we stopped it, I don't mean the ACLU, I don't mean lawyers or lobbyists or political machines, I mean South Carolinians from across the state, across the political spectrum. I was right in the middle of some of the public debate about this, and even still, the good news honestly caught me off guard. I didn't see it coming. So a couple of my colleagues, Courtney Thomas and Matt Butler, are going to join me in just a minute, and we're going to spend some time unpacking how that happened. But let's start with the basics before I bring them on. Now, normally, states are supposed to redraw congressional district maps every 10 years based on new census data so that each member of Congress represents an approximately equal number of voters. If you've heard of the concept of one person, one vote, that has to do with redistricting. In South Carolina's case, as in many states, elected officials in the state legislature get to redraw the maps. It's a politically fraught process every time, and whichever party holds a majority at the time will often draw the maps to secure an advantage for their incumbents and their candidates. They do this through a process of open, legalized cheating known as gerrymandering. The majority of Americans hate gerrymandering, but the parties keep doing it anyway. Now, we shouldn't be redrawing our maps until after the 2030 census. But on April 29th, 2026, the U.S. Supreme Court threw open the floodgates for redistricting at mid-decade by removing one of the key protections against the disenfranchisement of Black and Brown voters. In the case Louisiana v. Calais, the court gutted a section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that protected voters from racial gerrymandering. Things moved quickly after that. In southern states that have historically denied or diluted the votes of their Black citizens, legislatures started furiously redrawing their maps just as quickly as possible. The President of the United States demanded that they do this to favor his host party, the Republican Party, heading into this year's midterm elections. There was one problem. We were already in the middle of a primary election. Candidates had been campaigning, people had decided who they were going to vote for, mail-in ballots were already delivered to overseas voters, and early in-person voting was supposed to start on May 26th. And so with less than a month to go before early in-person voting, our legislature was dropping everything to prioritize ripping off voters, especially Black voters. And people took notice. People got mad. And somehow, at least in South Carolina, we stopped them. Today's episode is all about that month of chaos, protests, solidarity, brazen cheating, and political shenanigans. It's also about how we prepare for the next fight, because we will have to fight again, and soon. On that note, if you'd like to join the fight in one way or another, we can use your help. We have a form on our website at aclusc.org/volunteer. You can fill out a volunteer interest form, let us know what issues matter most to you, and we'll be in touch as opportunities come up, and we'll share news from the State House and news from your community. On that note, let's get into it. Here's my interview with Courtney and Matt. Matt, Courtney, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
As well as can be, Paul, which is, you know, pretty decent at the moment.
Yeah, hanging in there after a short respite, but, you know, diving back in and ready to continue the work.
So as we record today, it's June 9th, which is primary day in South Carolina. Not to put you on blast, have y'all voted yet?
I did. I voted early. I voted early at one of the locations in Richland County. So that was a real experience because there were so many helpful poll workers who were just excited to see people and just like really happy to be a part of the process. So I was excited to vote, obviously, but it was just nice seeing them and in their element.
Yeah, I voted early on the first day of early voting, and it was incredibly moving and powerful to be in line at 7 o'clock, you know, or 7:45, between 7 and 7:45, and then going in to vote. And as folks were coming out from voting, you know, normally we're so happy about the sticker, the I voted sticker, but like everybody in line clapped for everyone who came out from the voting booth, like from the voting center. And I voted in North Columbia at the Columbia College voting location. And just to hear everyone cheer and clap that another vote has been cast was really, really powerful and moving.
I've never seen that before. I'm voting on the actual primary day, like a slacker, I guess. And I'll wait for applause when I exit. I'll see if anybody claps for me. But that is really cool. And that is, I think, appropriate to what we're talking about today. You know, we're talking about how the sort of crazed push for redistricting came to an end for this year in South Carolina. And one factor, I'm sure it's not the only one, is we had just record-breaking turnout on the first day of early elections. The most ever, right, on record?
Yeah. I mean, it was so interesting being there in the lobby at the State House and watching legislators just hour by hour report out on the mic, okay, 25,000, 30,000, 31,000. I mean, they were excited because, you know, it helped their argument. But also, I think once we broke the record on the first day, it felt electric. Like, I've never seen this many people, especially elected officials, excited about people voting.
That was really stunning to see. So the big question that I want to address and maybe circle around for a little while today is, why did South Carolina stop redistricting while other states went full steam ahead with it? You know, I'm not here to cast shade on the other states. There are a million little factors, but I do want to try and reflect on what happened here, because honestly, I didn't expect this. I was a little caught off guard when redistricting just came to a screeching halt in the State House on May 26th. I don't know. I'm still kind of reeling from it, and I'm still trying to process why this happened. So maybe we can process this together. But let's start with this. So timeline-wise, we're looking at April 29th being the day that the Louisiana v. Calais decision came down from the Supreme Court. It gutted a major portion of the Voting Rights Act. From that starting line, legislatures across the country, but especially in the South, in the former Jim Crow states, started redrawing maps. For you, where were you when you found out that redistricting was coming to South Carolina, and how did you find out about it?
Gosh, I was in the State House, and the rumors circulate like wildfire up there, and there were rumors and whispers of maps being circulated, and as the drumbeat got louder, it became apparent that, well, this is what we're going to do. Here we are. This is happening. As more and more folks were discussing and talking about these potential maps, and it's really interesting because, I mean, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this, but redistricting is a process, and the map is the goal. So, you know, kind of talk about putting the cart before the horse here. But it was a map, of course, that you know, again, as the rumors were circulating and facts were coming out, were introduced not by anyone in South Carolina, but by a group out of DC. And so it became apparent, and folks were talking about, this is what the president wants, what President Trump wants, precisely because of the Calais decision, precisely because of the very public demands he had made on other, especially Southern legislatures, to redistrict.
Yeah, I know the State House can be a very gossipy place, but that part turned out to be true. I remember hearing rumors that the president was calling these lawmakers individually, and I'm usually a little skeptical, but that was true. He really did do that. That's what a scene to be a part of there. Courtney, did you hear about it in the State House, or how do you remember hearing about all this?
Yeah, I was there with Matt, and I actually remember Senator Devine just like saying something about the Calais decision in passing, like not really in relation to the map, because like at the time that alleged maps were being circulated, I think I was still trying to like digest what actually happened in Calais. The ink was still wet on the decision. Like there was no, I didn't think there was a general understanding about what happened. So then I remember, I think Matt, you sent me a screenshot of some photo from a reporter who like was looking over in the balcony and like saw map, like a physical map being passed around. And then you said something like, how can they tell what any of this means? It's literally just like colors on a page. It doesn't mean anything. And I remember sharing that rumor with some other members of our team, particularly our legal team. And they were like, well, a map is useless unless you have the VTD numbers. So, I mean, the very real reality until maybe later on in the House's redistricting debate, which I'm sure we'll get into, they were going to vote on a rumor, essentially. Like, they didn't have concrete information. They just had rumors of phone calls, maybe some photos of a map that couldn't really tell you where precincts were or where people were. It was just colors on a page, and they were ready to vote, which was maddening.
Yeah, I remember just sort of trying to zoom in and squint at these really grainy JPEGs and trying to figure out, okay, which district am I going to be in? And I couldn't tell because it didn't go down to the street level. It was, yeah, they were pushing forward a bill or in a map without really looking at it at all. And we finally did get a more detailed map with, you know, all the technical specifications that people need to, you know, make an interactive map and all that. And once we did, it was a pretty wacky map, right? I mean, it was, they were making some choices there. I think things that stood out to me, one, because I live in the Low Country, parts of Charleston County were getting put into a district with Myrtle Beach. There's some bad blood there, I suppose. Richland County got split three ways. Really bizarre slicing of the county and cutting into the capital city there. York County, we're looking at Rock Hill and Fort Mill getting split into separate districts. Someone from York County could tell you better, but I mean, those are basically, you know, sister cities. That doesn't make a ton of sense. None of it made any sense. These are not, I guess, what you would call communities of interest. It was a really bizarre drawing of lines with a very explicit goal of rigging it for partisan gain. I mean, that's the only way I think you could make sense of that map. Any other notes on the map itself? Was there anything about it that stood out to you once you finally got to look at the thing?
Yeah, you know, you said that Richland County was split. I mean, it looked like a toddler with a pizza cutter, you know, yeah, going through Richland County. And I live in North Columbia, and a majority of the Columbia, like, you know, east, you know, around Forest Acres, it did like a weird swirl with adjacent like outer parts that went into this new PD district. And then the swirl was split between the second district and what was proposed to be the new third district. And that third district went from my neighborhood over to the Savannah River, like kind of going west, and then kind of just hugging the Savannah and those counties along the Savannah all the way up to like Anderson and like Pickens and like the Pickens and the Coney area. So like all the way up into the upstate. And I'm like, going back to communities of interest, I have friends in Anderson, but like my community here in Columbia is wildly different than those communities in Pickens and Oconee County. And I think the folks over in York were even saying the same thing. Like, what do we, obviously we've got this split with Fort Mill and Rock Hill and even like portions of like each city being in separate districts. But they were like, what do we have in common with the folks over in Pickens County? You know, so it was like this weird kind of snaking around to kind of shove Greenville and Spartanburg together, you know, just this weird snaking into the upstate. And then, like you said, with that new district along the coast, yeah, that was offensive to so many people, both in Horry, Georgetown, and into Charleston County. For varying reasons.
And can we just like pause for a second? And because there's a lot of new vernacular, a lot of new language around this redistricting concept that is brand new to people that a lot of South Carolina had to learn quick, like within the month that all this was happening. So like when we say communities of interest, like as Matt was saying, you know, when you draw a map, you're thinking about the individual who would represent these people and you're making sure that their interests are aligned. So an example of that is like, if you are a congressman for the coast, you want to make sure everything on the coast, like you're considering the impacts of like fracking or tourism or like the port. So you would be asking a congressman who has a piece of the coast with those interests to then also turn their mind to the upstate that has nothing coastal about it. So when we say communities of interest, it's that the constituents who live inside those communities have aligned interests so that the one person who represents them wouldn't have to split their brain between what their constituents want.
Yeah, these are different communities with different concerns. I think, you know, Matt, you mentioned like that some of these districts were snaking around. That does kind of harken back to like the origin of the term gerrymandering, which was a district drawn, I think, to benefit somebody named Jerry, and it was shaped like a salamander. And gerrymandering is not just about funny shapes on a map, but I do think we should bring back the practice of like roasting districts for the way they're drawn. Like, just do some, like, you know, like when you look at clouds and say what they're shaped like, just have a little fun with it. Shout out we could give is to an organization called Be the Ones. They had an event where they were writing some letters about redistricting, and they went to a local pizza place and had like pizzas cut in bizarre, sort of irrational ways, as you know, an illustration of what was going on there. But beyond the funny shapes, and even beyond the sort of geographic communities of interest piece of this, one thing that we found out once, especially our national office was able to look closely at the maps and crunch the numbers, was just the sheer volume of voters who are getting moved around. In the final analysis, about 1 in 3 voting age South Carolinians would have been moved into a different district than they were before. I would have been one of them. A lot of us would have. But as with so many things in our state, that effect was more dramatic on Black South Carolinians. It was about 1 in 2 Black voting age South Carolinians who would have been redistricted. And that fact is just unignorable, I think, especially in a state with our history, when politicians start moving voters and especially Black voters around like pieces on a game board. That's real cause for concern. And I think people picked up on that. A common theme that we saw at a lot of the rallies and a lot of the public comments was, you are hurting Black voters especially. How did you see that sort of coming to the fore? Was that a common refrain that you heard throughout all this?
Yeah, it definitely was. I do have to give you your props, Paul. While this may not be correct, I'm going to say it. I got to give you some major, major credit for making the don't rig our maps thing really salient throughout this, because that's what it was. It was rigging. And I think that very simple message was something that resonated with people throughout many different communities, especially in the Black community, where people kind of understand the history of our state and the reason why the Voting Rights Act was passed in the first place. And seeing that replicated years later, like, well, years later, but like within the lifetime of people who were alive for the passage of the Voting Rights Act. One of our friends at ACLU National said that he talked to his grandma, who was alive when the Voting Rights Act passed. She still lives in Charleston and was shocked by the very concept that in her lifetime, what they fought for could be rolled back so swiftly. So I think what we saw with a lot of the testimony and a lot of the rallies and letter writing parties and things was that everyone understood that this would be detrimental to the majority of voters in South Carolina and then have an even worse effect on Black voters. So I think that was a very clear message that was really understood.
Yeah, I'm glad we were able to communicate that part of it, because I think no matter how closely you watch the news, you can understand when somebody is cheating. Like, it's fundamentally, anybody can get that this is about rigging, this is about cheating. And yeah, I think I saw so many examples of the same thing where, yeah, people who were alive before the Voting Rights Act were coming to bear witness and to say, I shouldn't be here fighting for my grandkids. You know, this should have been settled. And I do want to talk about the map drawer. I think there was a little bit of confusion at first about where this map came from. But once we finally got some clarity, it turned out that this map had been drawn by a guy. His name is Adam Kincaid. He works at the National Republican Redistricting Trust. And he's not like a celebrity. You know, unless you follow this kind of stuff, you probably haven't heard of his name. But he is notable for his role in rigging maps in places like Texas. He has a track record of this, and he's apparently proud of it. So there was one moment where South Carolinians got to hear from Adam, and it was during a House subcommittee meeting that he joined via a Zoom call, because yeah, he's a busy man, I'm sure. He spoke to the subcommittee via Zoom and gave them a hard cutoff time of, I think, 10 a.m. He had some other appointment. So he spoke about his map for, I think, 8 minutes, give or take, took no questions, and hung up. That was it. That was the extent of the explanation and the interrogation of this map. One guy on a Zoom call sort of looking bored, describing a map. That was it. Do y'all remember that moment? What was that like for you?
So what was really interesting, Paul, is because, you know, he was on camera, and I think it was in real time, we were getting information about him and about his previous work. And we were, I thought it was like even unprompted. Like, I think the old, the lady doth protest too much quote comes to mind, because he immediately offers up to the community, this is not a racial gerrymander. My maps are not based off of race. Like, a few times over, unprompted, he just was offering that up. And it was a head scratcher of course, again, no real opportunity to question or anything, but What are you trying to tell us if every third word, obviously I'm exaggerating here, is some type of defense of this map is not being based off of race?
Yeah. 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 He was pretty quick to explain that and very little else. But he also, explicitly said this is about securing a partisan advantage in these races. That's people pushing this map, I guess, to their credit, were pretty upfront about what they were doing. Like, we are here to cheat. Watch us do it. I don't think a decade ago we would have seen people being that brazen about it. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I wasn't here for the last round of redistricting.
No, I mean, I think it's so weird to yearn for the days of subtle racism, but I mean, it got pretty overt when on the Senate floor, a senator, Shane Massey, said, "You know what's going to happen? You're going to piss people off, and these black voters are going to turn out." And yeah, that's exactly what happened. But to the point about them being clear, like, we want a 7-0 map because it's what Trump wants and is what Trump said. There was, I think this was in maybe some of the Senate debate. You might remember this more than I do, Matt, but someone got up and said, "Well, when you win, you get to spike the football." Excuse me? Excuse me? This is a democracy, not totalitarianism. Like, democracy at its core is a plurality of voices. So it doesn't mean when you win, you get rid of all dissent. You get rid of anyone who doesn't agree with you. So 7-0, a 7-0 map is not a democracy. Like, I need us to be so serious.
Whoever said they spiked the football is probably not a college football fan, I take it. That you're very much not allowed to spike the football. Well, one other facet of this debate was just how fast it was. Like, they were really jamming this thing through. Again, like, let's talk about the timeline. We were right near the end of a 2-year legislative session. It was supposed to end May, somewhere in the middle of May. And so the clock was running out. They had other stuff to handle. They hadn't passed a budget, but suddenly it was like, we got to drop everything and pass this, just this. And I don't know. You've been in the state house. You've seen a lot of shenanigans over the years. How bad did it look to you? Like, how badly were they trying to rush this thing through the process?
So May 14th was what should have been the end of the regular session, and it was. There were so many just kind of interesting, I'm going to say, balls in the air about how all of this really went down. Because, yes, they're traditionally focused on the budget, like that's something that they want to get done before the end of the session. So they just dropped everything. The House started focusing on when the map started circulating after the Calais decision, and then it was like, oh, we're staring down a barrel here at the end of the regular legislative session on the 14th. Can we get this done by the 14th? No, let's see if we can't put this into the sine die resolution, which would extend things out for us to be able to continue to meet in Columbia to try and move this map along. And by sine die, that is that the last day of session. It's an old Latin term. And so, like, they put all the quote unquote normal, like the budget aside in order to address this. So, like, you have this whole movement of trying to get, on the one hand, a sine die resolution passed to allow for not only the normal stuff, like the budget meetings and the conference committees and X, Y, and Z for conference reports and other vetoes, but also to include language saying, oh, yeah, we'll come back for redistricting. We'll come back for redistricting. And then so, like, there's this fight over getting the House sine die resolution over to the Senate. And of course, that was, I think, like, one of the first kind of wins was the defeat of that sine die resolution in the Senate, which happens still in, at this point in time has compressed. So that might have been even like the very, that was the last week of session. And the Senate said, no, we're not going to pass this sine die resolution. There were a number of senators, bipartisan, voted not to adopt that sine die resolution. So that set us up for the governor having to call us back, call the legislature back into session. The governor had made some initial statements about not necessarily supporting this, or let's let the legislature decide. And the thought being at the time, well, the legislature has decided because they did not move forward with the sign and die resolution. You know, meanwhile, the House is still meeting. That Judiciary Committee is meeting. The subcommittee, and again, we worked with partners and other organizations and other, like, packed the room out. There was many hours of testimony. And if I'm not mistaken, other than the gentleman from the National Republican Redistricting Trust, at least in that setting, in that subcommittee, there wasn't anyone, that first subcommittee hearing, there wasn't anyone testifying in favor of redistricting.
I do want to talk about the people who showed up. I mean, you mentioned working with partners and allies across the state trying to get people into these meetings. I'm going to attempt to shout out as many as I can, acknowledging in advance that I'm forgetting some. But I mean, people we worked with, you know, that includes the League of Women Voters of South Carolina, Black Voters Matter, Be the Ones, the NAACP chapters around the state. Gosh, who else? So many different organizations and just like individual voters came out. I wanted to talk about the people who came out to speak to lawmakers, because I think in contrast to the map maker who zoomed in for 8 minutes, you know, in contrast to a few people who just sort of like zipped in and out of the room, gave a stump speech and moved on, there were people who sat and waited for hours to speak their piece to lawmakers during the few opportunities they had to do so. And that's a remarkable thing. You know, you have to rearrange your day, figure out time off of work, figure out your childcare if you have kids. It is an entire task to get up there and spend the time. Can we talk a little bit about just like who showed up? What sort of people came out and spent this time to speak on behalf of democracy?
Yeah, since like Matt, time has collapsed in on itself. I'm going to mention people who came for the like Senate side too, and I was really struck by a man with disabilities who came and talked about how difficult it already is to arrange transportation to get to the polls. And then let's say not just your precinct changes, but like your entire district changes. What do you do? And he talked about some of the major difficulties that exist in the current system, even without this disruption. So that was really significant to me. There were some folks who were organized by the Ubuntu Collective who came and really talked about the impact of Black voters. Black Voters Matter was involved as well. And really talking about the rippling effects that the decisions we make in South Carolina can have on the rest of the South at large. And I was also really struck by the veterans who showed up for the initial hearings themselves, but also while the Senate was on the floor making their decisions in the final days and the final hours, who showed up and like really just held vigil and said, I'm not going to let you disenfranchise people who are serving overseas right now. Because just to like back up, voting was already happening as this decision to redistrict was underway. So what the veterans were saying is that there were already hundreds of military service people and their families who had already cast votes. So if their district changed, their votes would have to be thrown out. So that was really significant to me. And I also think what really made a difference too was some of those same veterans who stayed there the entire time and called out their senators in the lobby and said, hey, come talk to me, because I'm not just gonna like sit here and watch you. I want you to talk to me and look me in my eyes as you're about to disenfranchise me. I was also really impacted by the faith community that showed up. So there was a prayer vigil that was put together by the Faith of Justice Table and the Ubuntu Collective. Being able to mobilize that many people of faith, but also their leadership, to say that this is not a partisan issue. This is on a lot of fronts, what people were saying, this is a moral issue. Like, you are cheating. You are taking away representation and really distorting democracy. So that's what stood out to me. There's so much more, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, more groups come into mind. Veterans for All Voters, South Carolina Tenant Union, Legal Defense Fund. One speaker who stood out to me, I met him when we held a rally on the State House steps. He was one of our speakers who I think is a more effective public orator than most people, myself included. But he also took the time to speak to those lawmakers in the room. A guy named Zuriel Nyamitsaka, who I didn't realize at the time was a high school senior from here in Charleston County. You know, he spoke about how this was affecting him as a first-time voter, soon to be. I think he was a good speaker, but I also think there was this really interesting moment where he was speaking to state senators in a subcommittee, and he asked them what they were so afraid of. One of them seemed really bothered by this. This was State Senator Josh Kimbrell from the upstate, who took the time to sort of lecture him and really sort of talk in a pretty demeaning way to a young man, a teenager. And, you know, Zuriel kept his cool. He was very gracious in the moment. But then throughout the rest of the night, there were all these different people, especially elders, like pastors, leaders from the civil rights movement, who, whatever else they were getting up to say, took a moment to say thank you to that young man for what he said. And then they read this state senator for filth. They said, and usually in politer terms than that, but they took the time to say, I have this person's back. And I think going to the state house is not fun most of the time. It's a task. It's grueling. It's emotionally taxing, among other things. But there are real moments of light and solidarity along the way that you might not expect if you've not gone through the process before. And I just thought that was a really beautiful thing that, you know, people were there for each other. These were intergenerational movements going on there.
I was also really moved by the Br'er Rabbit story. That was fun for me. That was good to be. That'll be a little treat if anyone wants to go back into the archives and find the full story. But I love that South Carolina really remained true to like who we are. We are a place that understands our history, but also there can still be a lot of joy even inside the struggle that is being civically engaged in our state. So whether it's a sermon or a improvised folk tale, or, you know, just like a kid, a young man coming to say, y'all, this is weird. This is, there are so many ways that you can be involved. It doesn't have to be so stiff. And I think that's what I took away from this too, like showing up however you are, that is also a part of democracy. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, people can be creative, and you have to be. And that's something that really stood out to me across that month. Also, just, you know, your work as our political team, Courtney, I think you have this hybrid role where you do political work in the state house, but you've also been doing some organizing. I think that's something that's not well understood outside the state house. Like, people don't really know what goes into that. Can you talk a little bit just about like what your work life was like over the course of that month? Like, how did you go about organizing people? What was that day-to-day work like for you?
Yeah. I think this was true for a lot of people who were organizing at the time, but like my work life became my entire life because with the compact time period, things were changing every single day, sometimes every hour. So I do want to emphasize the real power and strength of this is from people on the ground, but also people from other southern states like collaborating with us and bringing in their own resources or insights, because while South Carolina was going through this, the same thing was happening, maybe in a different flavor for other states like Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia. So there was a national call every morning at 9:30 a.m. with hundreds of people who were trying to figure out, okay, what's happening today? What did the court in this state say? How can we apply that to this state? What was an organizing tool that worked for y'all? Okay, North Carolina, you have a bus. Can you bring them down to South Carolina? What can each of us do to like work and build together? While I think South Carolina's victory is of course important to us, it was also a real light for people in other southern states who did not have the same results. So those 9:30 a.m. calls became a real like, let's catch up, what happened kind of moment, but also moving forward. There were lots of chats with lots of volunteers and organizers on the ground. There were lots of late night Zoom calls, lots of trying to explain what some of these pretty niche rules are, because for folks who don't know, the rules that govern how the legislature work are different in when redistricting is in play. So it felt like I was trying to relearn my job again while also still trying to teach the same thing to other people. There was that. And there was also just, you know, almost nightly events with the community. So we had a watch party for some of the debates at a church. Be the Ones had a pizza party. We had letter writing parties all throughout the state. There were folks who were coming in, it seems almost like at least twice a week throughout this month, to do rallies and vigils and like just to hold space in the state house. And it was honestly exhausting and inspiring. And I hope if people take anything away from this, it's that the same power that we showed up with for this redistricting issue can and should be applied to a variety of other issues. I'm not saying that everyone has to exhaust themselves on every single issue, but it does prove that we can show up and we can show up collectively. The thing that really sustained me as an organizer in this was kind of the informal support network that popped up with other organizers in the state. So like, if I could make a Zoom call, Matt would show up and like tell people what happened. Or if someone from the ACLU couldn't be at an event, another organizer from the Ubuntu Collective or Be the Ones or Black Voters Matter or the NAACP would step up and be a part of this collective learning moment that we were all in at stake. So I think we really cared for each other in a way that I haven't experienced in my relatively young organizing life. And I also will just end this question by saying I was also really encouraged by some of the concrete skills that people learned in this. People who had never put on rallies before figured out how to reserve space, how to get marshals, how to get medics, how to find legal observers. There were people who were tapping in to like make grocery store runs to get water and ice and volunteer. And there are people who are like doing carpools from all over the state. So even if you don't understand what the heck happened with redistricting, there are some things that everyone is walking away with. And I think that is just some of the building blocks of how to build a stronger foundational network of organizing in South Carolina. A lot of that already existed, but there are so many new people that are here. And it's really exciting.
I think one challenge throughout this was, keeping people up to date, because the intricacies of this are weird. And Matt and Courtney, y'all are better versed on how the state house is supposed to work than anybody I know. And it's arcane and strange. But there were also some moments where there was a false sense of security. There was a moment. And like, as a former journalist, it pains me to rag on the press like this, but May 12th, right around there were several headlines in the national press that communicated the message that the redistricting fight was over in South Carolina. Not to pick on the New York Times, but May 12th, South Carolina lawmakers halt redistricting efforts. They were not done, and we knew that, but if anybody only read the headline, it looked like, oh, whew, it's over. And so we had to be the bearer of bad news sometimes and tell people, no, like, actually, this fight is not over. And I think it was fortunate that right after that sort of batch of headlines, we had another rally already in the works. Partners had reserved the State House grounds, and we were able to hold a rally as a, like, very loud and visual reminder that, no, this isn't over. Like, they're still working on that in the building right now, and we got to keep fighting. I think another, if I can continue Paul's media gripe corner, I think there was a tendency sometimes in the press to overly personalize this, to have the stories be about following or rejecting Donald Trump and about protecting or rejecting specifically Jim Clyburn's seat in Congress. And I think that misses the mark. I mean, certainly those are important figures in this, but like, this is about the voters. I think beyond the, you know, handful of powerful people in the headlines and beyond like some of the machinations at play, voters were getting yanked around here. It's harder to tell that story because, you know, there are a lot of voters and it's there are a million different stories you could tell. But when we boil it down to Trump and Clyburn, and this is just about these two people, I think that misses something. That's not entirely what was going on here.
I was going to say, Paul, if I could jump on the bandwagon and ranting. I mean, you know, I think that, like, yeah, there was a lot of that just kind of boiling things down to Trump and to Clyburn. And I've had conversations with numerous friends who, for their own reasons, weren't able to really get involved. I mean, they were kind of passively involved, and certainly through conversation, that there seemed to be like just a broader failure in the media, you know, in ecosystem of just basically informing South Carolinians on what exactly was going on and why it should be important, no matter what the outcome of it would be, whether redistricting actually happens or it doesn't happen. But just the general, like, you know, well, what is redistricting? Why do we do this? And why is it so different or weird to do something like this mid-cycle? You know, no matter what the outcome would have been, it seemed to have been like a missed opportunity, and you know, probably 100,000 different reasons that most of the outlets, not the national folks, even like the local folks, you know, could not, you know, have been able to do those kind of pieces. But obviously, though, other organizations certainly stepped into the gap. Give plaudits and give you your flowers, Paul, for being a resource and putting information out. Other partners, League of Women Voters and others, to just, you know, if you get beyond those personalities, those big personalities of Trump or Clyburn, it really is about just the basics of screwing the voter.
I don't know if we're any closer to an answer about what stopped redistricting for this year, but I think we have a lot of answers. I think, you know, we talked about, you know, the turnout in these subcommittee hearings, just hours of people speaking against it, sort of public actions that shifted the narrative and kept the focus on all types of procedural stuff going on in the House that ultimately dragged this debate on and on until it got to the first day of early voting. And then, yeah, the testimony of people like veterans who were speaking on behalf of military service members who had cast ballots overseas. And then finally, when it came time to vote, people showed up, and they really showed up. And I can't pin it on any one of those things. I don't know. I'm sure you get asked this a lot. Maybe, you know, when you're spending time with family or friends asking what work is like, how do you explain it? How do you explain what just happened here?
I'd say it's a good, healthy mix of all of those things, of organizing, of educating, of engaging, I said to one senator on that early day of voting, I was like, the people are coming out and they are, through their vote, they are vetoing these efforts that y'all are underway. They are saying to you, stop. So, you know, it was a people's veto. We might not have an initiative, ability here in South Carolina, but the voters showing up on that day after a culmination of two incredibly fast weeks of just organizing, education, and engagement across social media platforms, through so many different organizations, through, you know, even with the reporting of legacy media, when they weren't talking about this as just a Trump or a Clyburn thing, you know, folks woke up and they said, how can I participate to stop this? And they voted.
I think it's also worth noting that, and I know how strange it's going to sound to say, we really have to emphasize that this was a bipartisan victory. There was incredible leadership out front and behind the scenes from both Democrats and Republicans. There are Republicans who will probably never get their due for being behind the scenes and, you know, talking to their colleagues about this, but they were also a part of this victory. And I think that is important. And I think that really does go to some of the, if you want to understand the state politically, I think this was a very interesting case study. While we have no real conclusions, I think it's important to recognize when Republicans speak out, that is important. When the people speak out, that is important. When Democrats are organized, that is important. When there's an understanding of how to use the process, that is important. Because a lot of the wins that we were able to see from the House and the Senate, it was really because somebody, whether it's on staff or in the lobby or an elected official, understood how the rules worked. So it's not something that is maybe easily digested by like us in the public, but I think all of that matters. So everybody has their part to play in democracy.
I go back and forth on whether shame works as a sort of lever against our politicians. Some of them, I think, are immune to it. I don't think they feel shame. Yeah, whatever the motivation, there was this real turning of the tide on May 26th. And it could be that lawmakers had their own ulterior motives, that they were, you know, they were worried that redistricting could backfire. Some of them said that publicly. Some of them had like procedural questions that weren't necessarily moral ones, but just that, well, this isn't the right way to go about it. Or it could be that the sheer mass of people voting did shame some of them, that they were looking at the prospect of throwing out tens of thousands of legally cast ballots from South Carolinians and realizing they didn't want that heat. They didn't want the shame of undermining public confidence in elections that way. I want to believe that at least some of them were swayed by that. I don't know. I don't know these people. I don't know their hearts. But yeah, there are so many different reasons they could have arrived at it. But ultimately, they did. They did stop redistricting. Pause for 2026. And this is where we do our part to maybe put a little damper. We have celebrated. We should celebrate. This is monumental. I think this was a really remarkable thing that South Carolinians achieved. As we have to every year, we have to remind people that a victory is not permanent. And especially in this case, I think, Courtney, Matt, you've mentioned, like, this is coming back. They're going to try this again, maybe next year. Talk to me about that. Like, what can we sort of guess is coming in 2027?
Well, certainly, I think a renewed scrutiny of not only the congressional maps, but also potentially state house maps. So we could, there's an election this November that encompasses all 124 members of the House. So we could see an effort in 2027 to try and review those lines even further, as We don't know what the election outcome will be, but I imagine if the supermajority stays a supermajority, if certain caucuses expand their influence within the majority, that we will see efforts to redraw lines of the local House districts, not just those federal House districts. We would likely see both. No matter, we will see, I think we'll see it happen, and we will probably see it happen on, again, an abbreviated schedule.
And to Matt's point, any effort to redistrict before the next census is not a good thing, because the purpose of the census is to tell us where people are. So even trying to redraw state house map lines before that, like, census every 10 years, you'd still be using old data. No matter what news outlet is your favorite, I'm sure every couple of weeks you've probably seen or read or heard a story about how South Carolina is one of the fastest growing places in the country, right? Especially if you live in like Greenville or Charleston. I think particularly for people who have seen their communities change and grow and shift, it is in your interest to make sure that this does not happen before the next census. In some ways, they've kind of made the runway a little clearer for us as organizers and advocates. We know the issue now. We understand these words. We have a base of people who will turn out. And now they are, I'm sure, going to be upset again. We just told you no, and you're going to try it again months later. So I think it really writes itself. Our job as advocates is to keep the pressure up.
Yeah, and so will we. I'm so glad that y'all are going to be there, and that so many of the people that we met over the last month or so are going to be there. Nothing is a done deal, but I'm so encouraged by all the people I've met on the way. This has been a real time of restoring my faith in my neighbors. We always ask our guests, given the title of the show, While I Breathe, I Hope, what has given you hope right now?
I am, again, hopeful for all of the people who were able to be engaged in this work and learn very quickly and really put boots on the ground and do this work. But I'm also really hopeful because people got a win. It's so important. First day at organizer school, they tell you to communicate your wins and to help people feel hopeful. Whenever I do an ACSI 101, I talk about a bill that I worked on that took years to pass. But this was an abbreviated timeline for the effort, but also for the victory. So I think it gave people inspiration and hope. And I love when people are new to organizing work or to paying attention to the state house and things go their way. Because, like, I'm rooting for the issue, but I'm also rooting for you. Like, I want you to stay. I want you to be involved. I'm really glad that we got to experience all of this together. Hope is a thing that is sometimes rare when you're fighting for civil liberties in the South Carolina State House, but we got it. It worked.
I'm just going to say plus one. Yeah, plus one to my colleague Courtney there, because you hit the nail on the head, my friend. We don't see, you know, we've been in a defensive posture, and you know, we translate the wins when we get them. We, you know, also gather with our communities when they don't come around, and we've got those proactive things that seem a little bit harder to get. But, you know, seeing folks engaged, waking up, becoming engaged, and sticking through this process, building out that community of people. And it's not just about coming to Columbia. You know, it's about seeing folks who are engaged and continue to be engaged, you know, in their hometowns, in their local, in their neighborhoods, and in their local communities, and how they will now stand up, speak out, get involved, stay engaged. That's what gives me hope.
Really grateful to both of y'all for the work you do, the wisdom you bring, the arcane knowledge of state house rules that you possess. And I also want to thank you for taking the time to talk. Thanks for coming on the podcast again. Talk to you soon. Thank you again for listening to While I Breathe. If you enjoyed today's episode, please tell your friends and leave a nice review. If you'd like to find ways to get involved in the struggle to create a multiracial representative democracy here in the ash heap of the Confederacy, we do have a volunteer form. It is at aclusc.org/volunteer. That's all for now. Jace will be back next episode. Thanks for bearing with me. Until next time, while I breathe, I hope.